This is called In Conversation, and you're at the Hirshhorn Museum. And just to kind of let you know about In Conversations and the way that they work, is they are hour-long conversations usually with artists, between an artist and myself, an artist and a curator, or an artist and someone else from the Smithsonian. And usually what's great about bringing in someone else from the Smithsonian, like Carlene Stevens, is that we can talk about things that are really an interesting way of looking at art, which is that a lot of artists do research that goes beyond just making art and into more other topics that kind of inform what they do as artists. And this is an especially great opportunity because of the Smithsonian Research, the Smithsonian Artist Research Fellowship, which allows artists to come to the Smithsonian and have and to work with the other Smithsonian museums along with art museums, and to kind of research their interests and not actually have to produce work, but just research and just kind of explore their own ideas through the Smithsonian collection. So it's always a great opportunity to have these interdisciplinary dialogues and to be able to bring in someone else from another museum and talk about the connections art has with science, with technology, with other fields, so that it's not just alienated and cut from budgets. So I'm always finding that this is a great opportunity to talk about the permeability of the fields of art with the sciences. So that said, in conversations, usually work out that there's a conversation and also a presentation, and then we'll dim the lights for that, and then the lights will come back on, and then this microphone will go around. People can ask questions. They're very informal, and we just really want to kind of get conversations going about ideas and art. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our artist here, Lynn Myers. She's a DC area artist in resident. She received her BFA at the Cooper Union in New York City and her MFA at the California College of Arts in San Francisco. She has been the recipient of many awards and fellowships, most recently the Smithsonian Artist Research Fellowship, and she's also been in 2008 our artist in residence here at the Hirshhorn. Her work is in numerous private collections and museums, and she has been featured in museums and galleries internationally. She has work in our collection here at the Hirshhorn, and she's also in the collection of SAM. Hi, if you can just come on down to the front, that'd be great. Lynn's exhibition is titled At the Time Being, and this is at the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C., and it will be on view through August 22nd, so please don't miss this. It's gallery-specific, and it's been extended, and it's been extended. So please go. And she's represented by G Fine Art in Washington, D.C. Carlene Stevens is the curator of the division of work and industry, and that's at the National Museum of American History, the Smithsonian Institution. So she's our neighbor down the street, and she takes care of the museum's historical collections of clocks and watches, locks, instruments for sound recording, and robots. So I might have to ask you the connection between some of those things.
I will tell
okay.
you, sir.
And she recently was the project director and curator of On Time, the museum's exploration of how America has learned to live by the clock, which I find really interesting. Her exhibition book is called On Time, and it was published in 2002 by Bullfinch Press of Little Brown. Her current exhibition at the museum is a gallery in science and American life called Looking Ahead, Robots on the Road. And she's also has an exhibition that's coming up. It's a project that's underway at the National Air and Space Museum. And it's a history of the relationship of time and navigation. And she's also collaborating with the Library of Congress and the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory on a project involving the museum's earliest sound recordings. And her research in progress is a history of the electronic wristwatch. So what's really exciting to me is here are two very different people with two very different practices, and yet what I've been excited about is the conversations I hear them having about the relationships between time and art making and just ideas about time in general. So anyway, we'll see what happens today, and thank you for joining us. Can everyone hear them? Would you guys just do a little
test? Hi, everybody.
So people can hear them?
Just
okay.
Project.
I can do that.
Okay. So thanks. So let's get started. I guess the lights are going to have to go down, and we're going to talk about the first slide here on your PowerPoint.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have about 5 or 6 slides. I promise not to go on too long because my slides are not particularly described as art. But what I would like to do, for starters, is say a little bit about how I come to the subject of time. And the way that I come to the subject of time is very much a function of working in the National Museum of American History, which before its present incarnation was the Museum of History and Technology. So like other technical museums, our mother and father institutions, Deutsches Museum in Munich, the Science Museum in London, we had a traditional, very comprehensive collection of clocks and watches that were collected not as decorative objects, not as pieces associated with famous people, although we do have some of those, but pieces of machinery. Clocks and watches were treated in the museum for their internal technical development. This achievement, that achievement, and so on, down the centuries. So when we became the National Museum of American History, the mission changed. Collecting of these things continued. I shouldn't say it as though no person was doing the collecting. I was doing the collecting. But the mission for sharing information about these objects changed from presenting the story of the internal technical developments, the improvements in clocks and accuracy, changed from that to how clocks and watches figure in United States history. So how do you do that with a bunch of clocks and watches? So what's interesting to me as someone who's, among other things, studies time, is how people behave in time. How they think about time or they don't think about time. A lot of people take time for granted, except to say they don't have enough of it. But where I ended up is being interested in the conventions that keep us all moving together in time, whether we want to be moving together in time or not. I brought some slides of things and illustrations to show not only that personal journey that I made, but also how it's possible to take this enormous subject of time, even take the smaller subject of clocks and watches, and put them in different contexts. And I'm sure you'll see that when Lynn talks about the pictures that she has brought, she has another slice of time, as though time is a pie. But the subject is enormous. We probably could have an audience full of people who each have their own slice of this enormous subject and have people standing in line outside the door. So lots of different ways to look at this, and you'll hear about some of them today. So I brought some pictures of things from American History's collections and Natural History's collections to show that when the United States got started as a country, people were intensely mindful of time, but not clock time. We run pretty much by clocks and calendars today, but that conch shell was used to call people to worship at the First Congregational Church in Whately, Massachusetts in the 18th century. Somebody would, there's a cut hole in this shell and they blow it like a trumpet. So people respond to the sound of the shell like a horn, like a bell in the belfry, and they know the right time to show up. The mask is from the Natural History Yupik Indian collections. It represents time in religion of a different sort. This represents one of the Yupik Indian heroic gods who lives in the moon. And the appearance of the moon, the appearance of this particular mask, precedes the hunting season. So people are setting up their rituals in this kind of seasonal way. And then the sand glass was used in American churches and schoolrooms to mark the passage of time intervals. It's not time of day, but how much time has elapsed. Has the minister's sermon gone too long? Flip that hourglass. Has the teacher talked too long in the schoolroom? Flip the hourglass. So I can change this, right? I do have a few things to say about traditional clocks. Clocks initially, from their first invention somewhere in Europe sometime around 1300 AD, are very expensive, they're very rare, and they usually are not in people's homes. They're usually a town clock or a church clock. But here we have an example from about 1700 in Philadelphia for someone's house, and it's really not for exclusively for timekeeping. If you look really closely at the dial, it's got one hand, so you can estimate the time to the closest portion of an hour. Oh, that's okay. You're doing very well. I'm interested in the span of time covered by watches, and what I have here are some examples of portable time. Once we can afford to make watches by machine, once we can have lots of watches, just about everybody can afford to have some version of time with them, on the wrist, in the pocket. The examples that I brought here are a movement from the First American Watch Company from the time of the Civil War. The middle watch is actually one of the earliest ladies' wristwatches from about 1914. And then right up to the high-tech end, the one on the right, is a German-made watch that corrects itself by a radio signal in the middle of the night if you want to sit up and watch it. There are these sorts of watches and clocks made in this country now. So, great. And I am kind of rounding out my story here. Clocks these days don't look anything like the traditional dial that we know of. Two scientists pictured there with the most accurate clock in the United States, which sits in a laboratory of the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado. And those are the clockmakers there. They're actually physicists these days, not mechanicians. For the GPS satellites, which are providing a precise time and location to those of us who are earthbound, those atomic clocks have been shrunk down to that thing that looks like a document box, and that's about the size of it. And then a receiver, a military receiver, for those signals from the GPS satellites. And I feature these because this is kind of the time and navigation storyline that is interesting me now. In this process of thinking about time, thinking about how people measure, use, and think about time, I'm really concerned about how people actually experience time. And I personally have a very difficult relationship with my alarm clock because I don't want to wake up in the morning. And maybe some of you in the audience can relate to this. And the need to get up and be at a certain place at a certain time is one of the things that we as a culture learn. We don't start out instantly as a culture setting up schedules and being on time. We have to learn how to do all those things, learn how to set up schedules, learn how to synchronize ourselves, and then develop a time discipline to get ourselves where we're supposed to be. Some of us never do. I'm always late, which is probably how I got into this subject anyway. The need to synchronize ourselves intensifies the cultural and social need to synchronize ourselves. Intensifies in the roughly around the 1880s. Industry is on the rise in this country. Workers are no longer working in small workshops. There might be 15 or 20,000 people working in a factory setting. And the idea that anybody can show up at any time that he or she wants to doesn't work if you've got a manufacturing process. I'm also interested in the conventions we use, the origins of the conventions we use to observe zoned time, Eastern, Central, Mountain, Pacific, and the related business of why daylight saving time. And I'm also interested, as a historian, in what happens when we are able, because of our communication systems, because of the internet, because of our ability to light up the night, what happens to us as basically diurnal creatures when we can go as a society around the clock? And this is where I very distinctly remember my first conversation with Lynn. You were fascinated, I remember, by the Frenchman who pioneers in what's now called chronobiology. He immerses himself in a cave, sensory deprivation to completely remove himself from any signals of sun, moon, stars, clocks, alarm clocks, or any sort of TV, radio, and you wanted to know what this was all about, right?
Yeah, and I think this is the segue, right?
This is the segue. Lynn, take it.
Are we gonna switch there? Okay. That whole story of Michel Siff totally fascinated me. And the part that I got stuck on, if you go to the slideshow, the part that I got stuck on was when he was always in communication with people above ground one of the pieces that I really love, when he was asked to count out 2 minutes and it took him 5 minutes. That was after he'd been underground for a while. Initially I thought that I was going to do my fellowship was going to center around the Foucault's pendulum that used to be at the museum before it was changed around. But that didn't work out. And so I was forced to think a little bit more about... Yeah, and then you got a slideshow, I think, up there. Yeah. Uh-oh. I don't know how to do this. PC. Okay. So that wasn't there anymore, and because it's an object that is only an object when it's installed in a space, it wasn't really possible to do a fellowship centered around that. But when I started thinking more about why I was interested in that, and then I read this article on Michel Siff, I put the whole thing together. This is a slide by a photographer named Bernice Abbott. And it is a pendulum, not a Foucault's pendulum, but a pendulum, which comes up a lot when you start investigating time. Let's see. Okay, and I stuck this in there because one of the reasons I think that we may be obsessed with time is because of our mortality and that feeling of never having enough time. on a daily basis and in our lives in general. So this is a genre that was very much focused on that idea. And I just want to show a few slides of other artists whose work, for me, relates very directly to this. So this is Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty, and it was created in 1970, and then this is a photograph of it in 2008, so you can see how much the piece has changed over the years. And I cannot pronounce this artist's name. Thank you, Milena. But I just thought this was an interesting way of thinking about clock time.
Clock time.
And, you know, pushing the envelope with that. And this is a still from a video that actually the artist Guido van der Werf showed here at the Hirshhorn. He had an installation in the black box of a different piece. But so he went to the North Pole and stood in one spot, stood on the North Pole, and for 24 hours was filmed rotating against the rotation of the Earth so that he wasn't turning. And I think that is, I'm very moved by that piece. I think it's really beautiful. And another artist who did a video that relates to time, this piece was in the black box a year or two ago. She's standing in front of a river, Kim Suja, standing in front of a river, and the whole piece is just the river passing before her and things floating through the water. And I just saw this performance yesterday at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. So this is Abramovic, and she's sitting in the museum from when the museum opens in the morning to when it closes in the evening. She sits still. She doesn't get up and go to the bathroom. She doesn't eat. She doesn't drink. She just sits there. And anyone who visits the museum can come and sit across the table from her. She really sits still. She doesn't move very much. It's interesting that I wanted to sit with her, but a lot of people sit with her for a really long period. So, you know, you'd have to wait in line possibly for hours. So I didn't get to do it, but I would like to.
I mean, that particular person was there all day. The slide that you just showed?
That young woman?
Yeah.
Was she really?
Yeah. Oh, no, not that woman. There's one who, I thought there's one who dressed just like her and was there the whole day.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
The woman who I was with said that she wouldn't be able to stay very long because she'd be worried about the people in line behind her. I thought it was really ironic when you're talking about this subject. And the reason I put this up there, obviously we've been talking, you know, on the radio, there's been so much coverage of the Hubble. But I started thinking about how far away these things are that we have looked at and photographed, and the fact that we're actually photographing something that doesn't exist anymore. So I don't know, I thought a lot about that while I was putting this slideshow together, and came across this fact, which you probably know, that when we're looking at the sun, we're actually looking at light that was emitted 8 minutes before.
Because it takes that long to travel here. Yeah.
So it's a way of seeing through your eyes the past, mm-hmm. rather than memory. And this is one of my works. It's a drawing that I did this year, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with my work. This is a detail. And another piece, another recent drawing, and a detail. And now I just want to show a quick video of the piece at the Phillips Collection right now.
Yeah. And while we're waiting, maybe I could ask you a question. I mean, time comes up when we look at your work. It takes a lot of time. And I guess, do you experience it differently because you're drawing? And is there a way that you mark time with your drawing?
I think most visual art is marking time in one way or another. It's just a question of how much the artist is focused on that. You know, time, the work as an event versus a picture.
Right, right.
So I definitely think about that. But I also, you know, anyone who's deeply involved in the work that they're doing loses track of time. So I don't think that's specific to art making, although it certainly happens with me. Mm-hmm. What I do think is particular to the work that I'm doing, not that it doesn't relate to other artists, but is the idea that I actually am documenting every moment. And so, and in order to do the drawings that I do, I can't skip ahead of myself, and I can't be thinking about what I just did. I really have to be on point with the drawing and the line. So in that way, it's a little bit different than what some other people do. We can roll this. Hopefully, it's not gonna be too long.
I remember it's extended through August, so.
I don't know if I should narrate this, but those were little preparatory drawings that I did. This is the layout for the drawing, and so I use a pencil drawing that's sort of a matrix that the rest of the drawing is wrapped around. And the reason I asked for the video to be shot like this was so that you could see the individual drawings that become embedded in the larger piece. So you can see this the development in a way that actually has individual compositions. And so this is the first side that I completed, and this is the second side. You can see each one of them through a separate archway, and then when you go through either one of those arches, you can see the whole thing.
Is that a sponge tip that then the ink is loaded into? Or
it's
like a marker?
It's a little bit like a felt tip pen, but it's harder.
Okay.
And the little nibs are replaceable, so I probably worked through 50 nibs working on this just because they get dulled down from running across the wall. One thing that happened while I was working on this is that originally when I had spoken with Vesela about doing this project, I went back to my student and I thought, wow, you know, this is really subversive doing a wall drawing at the Phillips Collection, you know, because it's all about these, you know, really important paintings in their gilded frames. And I thought it was going to maybe bother people or shock people, or maybe it would be, maybe people would take it in as wallpaper. I really wasn't sure, but those were the ideas that I had about it. And it turned out that that wasn't what happened at all. What happened was that people latched on to the fact that it's not permanent because, well, I think because they go to the Phillips to see these great works of art that, you know, have been cherished and that are being kept very carefully. And here's this work of art that is completely impermanent. And I think that's what Vesela was saying about the extension of the exhibition. It bothers people. And it becomes the relationship between the Van Gogh or any one of the other works there that is so precious and a prized object, the relationship between that and something that you see and then it will be gone.
Mm-hmm.
So.
When she was talking about your work, did anything come up to you about any questions at all?
Well, it was this business of the impermanence, exactly. I don't see a parallel between the things that I collect, but I certainly see a parallel between the impermanence of the work and sort of the impermanence of exhibitions in general. That the juxtaposition of objects and images in an exhibition in any setting is as powerful as the individual parts. And so when you talk about the difference between the permanent collection at the Phillips and your installation, it's also the juxtaposition of those objects with your work that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
Because of the, and I wouldn't have thought of that except for the video. The video captures that completely.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought was really interesting.
I mean, what I'm interested in is there's an aspect of performance to doing drawings that way. There are drawings that are impermanent, like performance is impermanent. Your body is definitely engaged when you work on that scale. And so, to me, when you talked about how people experience time, are there time pieces that measure how the body experiences time? I mean, you know, because in some ways that's what the artist is doing doing the drawing.
And that goes back to the work that Michelle Siff did, the
right.
chronobiology.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's a set of experiments,
right.
rather than it would be multiple instruments recording
uh-huh.
different physiological functions, I uh-huh. guess. But
so, would you be willing to be hooked up to those instruments while you do your drawings?
I'm not sure that would be very interesting.
Do you get bored sometimes when you do it, or do you really? Because you're so connected to what you're doing.
I don't. I think it's the factor of being present that prevents any sort of boredom. I'm really and there's a sense of anticipation which we haven't talked about yet, but the sense of not looking towards the future, but the future being an unknown entity which will play a role in how this thing develops. That whole arrow of time thing where you can stand back and you can see what you've created and you can wonder what it will be when it's finished. So, I mean, I found a lot of parallels in some of the things that I came across while I was doing the fellowship here. To that experience of my art making parallels in science and in the study of time.
I actually had a question about
yeah.
your process. You explained a little bit that you do a rough mm-hmm. preview or preliminary.
The sketches, or
right?
The, right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do that, do you have a sense of what it's going to be when it's finished, or you really don't?
I have a very general sense.
Uh-huh.
So the preparatory drawings are a way of planning out the basis for the composition, but they take on a very different feeling because they're so small. The scale of the line in relation to the matrix is so different, and the movement that produces my movement that produces the movement in the drawing doesn't scale up as much as the drawing scales up.
Uh-huh.
So the slippage that you might see in a preparatory drawing, the places where the lines get wiggly and then that causes this sort of pattern to occur, the scaling of that, it's not as grand as the difference between a drawing this big and a drawing that's 15 feet or 20 feet.
Right.
Because it's still my body. It's the difference between my wrist and this and
the
this
range
joint
of motion
here. Yeah.
I don't mean this to be frivolous either, but is the latter your friend or your foe? I mean, is it an extension of all that?
Yeah, I think it's just part of it. I don't really think about it
uh-huh.
until I get to the part of the drawing where I need to reach up higher than I can reach, and then I grab the ladder. But it becomes more of an instrument, the way that the okay. mark-making tool is an instrument. Yeah.
Now, why did you ask about the ladder?
Well, because I come from this background in the history of technology, I'm used to thinking about people and their tools.
Uh-huh.
It's easy enough to think of an artist with some sort of pen or ink or something in the hand that makes a line or a mark. But in this sense, the ladder is part of your bag of tools,
right.
a box of tools.
Right.
And if you didn't have the ladder, the finished product would look completely different.
Yeah, it actually could happen. Yeah. I mean, I could decide that I wasn't going to use a ladder and that the height of the drawing would be as far as I could reach standing on my tippy toes.
Right.
But it is an interesting idea, because the reason that I like to draw is that it's so direct and that there's no interruption, you know, needing to mix paints or load a brush with paint or look away and look back.
It's a continuous motion.
Right, exactly. Right. And the ladder is pretty much the same thing, although there is the climbing up and down when I need to see what I've done.
Right.
But that's not that different than needing to just back away from the drawing in general to see what I've done.
There's a whole genre of still photography and video or film photography that's now getting a lot of attention as a historical subject. It's these time and motion studies from the period of the early 20th century, right up into the 1960s. Time and motion studies are very much a part of engineering. But I'm thinking specifically of a collection of photos and films from the Gilbreths, made famous by the Cheaper by the Dozen story of the efficiency experts. And these things really are photographs of people at their most extended. You know, what is the path of motion while they're making a part? Or what is the reach of a housekeeper so that you can design a kitchen so that the cupboards are in the right place or the counter is in the right place?
Oh, that's like in the 20s. I think there's some designers in the 20s. And maybe it's through Bauhaus. But I remember studying this at some point where it was all about, is it ergonomics?
Yeah. What they called that at the time.
With the kitchens were actually quite small so that you could stand in one place and reach everything. From where, because it was more efficient in terms of your use of time as well as your body. So this is like this weird crossover with the use of the body and the time. But that's designing a space as opposed to a tool, which is kind of interesting.
Exactly.
I guess for me, because she brought up tools, and I watch people looking at their phones all the time. I don't have a highfalutin phone. So a smartphone. But did it fall off? Speaking of tools. So what I do look at people's phones, and I'm like, wow, people look at their phones all the time now. And so that must be they must be experiencing time in a very different sort of way. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily physical. I guess it's physical engagement because they're looking at the clock or they're looking at whatever is on there, but it's very different. I mean, have you thought about any of this stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
The way that people pass their time while they're waiting is different. Because basically you see these people standing around waiting for something, either to get on a bus or they're on the metro waiting for the ride to end, or they're waiting for something else to happen or to be somewhere else. And they're passing the time not by watching other people or looking up and around, but by focusing on what is in the palm, in the hand.
So for a people watcher like me, I'm like, no one's looking. I'm just watching them look at other things.
Right.
So it's always such a strange thing. But then I think about what you do, and in some ways you've created an alternative sense of time where you are very connected to the moment when you're doing your process, you know. And so I guess that's, I don't know, I guess that's an observation. Does it make you think about anything?
Well, I think a lot of us notice everybody staring at their smartphones.
Yeah.
And I've wondered how different it is than just reading a book, but it is different because everybody's doing it. It used to be that, you know, you'd see a number of people on the metro reading books and the rest of people would be staring out into space or people watching, and now not everybody, but probably 80% of people at some times are looking. And you know, there's also this certain expectation of a way of using your time that, you know, you are to respond quickly now.
Yes.
It didn't used to be that way. You would get a letter in the mail, you would write a letter back. And that correspondence took some time, and because of that there was a thinking that took place in between, And that's gone.
So could we say that the tools that we use are changing our sense of time as well? That we're marking it faster now? Or somehow that's happening?
It feels like it changes the relationship. You know, we've talked about synchronizing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It seems like it has changed that we have to be more synchronized. We're coming closer together in the way we're each experiencing time because we're relating so quickly to one another. Rather than having days in between.
Yeah.
And synchronization is a big part of what you've been studying too in terms of timepieces, right?
That's right.
And I think we talked earlier, and I don't know if we touched on this yet, but the idea that artists are providing alternatives to time, which I kind of like. Because even the process of being a working professional artist is that you do have a different sense of time in terms of your day. Your day is carved out based on whatever you want to do. So, I guess for me, would you say what is the sense of time that you're creating that might be alternative? That's loaded, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry, but would you say that? I'm not sure what my question was there. I think it had more to do with just that idea of artists providing an alternative to working with the kinds of tools that create our conventional set of time. Mm-hmm. And you never, I mean, was time always a part of it, or did you kind of fall into this more and more?
You know, when it actually started to become more of a piece of what I was doing was when I went on a residency, and it was the first residency that I'd gone on that actually was very long term, and I didn't have to teach, I didn't need to be doing anything other than making my work. And I found it overwhelming. Because I didn't have a family there. I had nothing that I didn't have mail to open. You know, I had very few responsibilities other than being in the studio and making my work. And that was a big change, even though before I went there, I was a full-time artist. It just shifted. And I needed to do work that embraced that, because otherwise I was completely paralyzed. And that's when it actually became one of the ingredients that I was using.
So you kind of had the opportunity to go back before time was being marked by someone other than yourself in that situation.
Yeah, I began to mark it with my own alphabet or my own language.
Uh-huh.
Very carefully.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't just a matter of, you know, making art as an event. It became making art over a defined period of time from when I got up in the morning to when I was done in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Without interruptions. I have to create interruptions.
Uh-huh.
Because there was so much time to do this.
So, great. So, should we open it up to... Okay, could we have the house lights on? And we'll use this microphone that I have now for questions.
A pretentious and self-indulgent question, and I apologize in advance. But back in the day when I was in college, I actually allowed myself to believe that not only the devices we've invented to depict or measure time, but that time itself was an artifact of civilization. And we just used it to give context to the natural processes of growth and maturation and decay that we were subject to. And it also allowed me to rationalize away the sin of not respecting other people's time and being late for class and stuff like that. Well, a few years later, I was reading a little bit of Hawking, the very little bit I could understand. Turns out, time is a real thing. It's not an artifact. It's a natural phenomenon. And it comes with its own properties. And one of which is that it always moves forward. It must always move forward, or at least out. And that kind of divided my notion of time. Now you have the thing itself, and you have the artifacts, the things we do invent to measure it. And your work is involved with the one. And it seems to me artists and scientists both now have the option of trying to get at the thing itself, not only to measure it, but maybe to manipulate it and put it to some use, different use, instead of it putting us to you, its use. And I'm wondering, I kind of see that in your work, and I'm wondering whether in your imagery it's correct to think that your notion of the thing itself, it may actually be floral in nature, It may not be strictly linear, but have a wave-like quality to it. Am I on to anything there in looking at your imagery?
Sure. I don't know that the imagery itself relates to... I'm not exactly sure if you're implying that the imagery relates to something outside of the work that I'm doing. Are you? Yeah. It doesn't really. It's very self-referential. It sort of grows out of what I have been doing to the next thing. But what you're saying is certainly playing a role. And you know, as far as time being a real thing, I think that is somewhat cultural, even though Hawking can talk or write about it in a way that explores that. I think that the way that we experience time is really, I mean, as you said, that, you know, you're talking about working by clock time, and then there's experiential time, there's event time. I mean, all this stuff is written about. I didn't make any of it up. So there's time being a thing is, in some ways, the arrow of time is the one thing that we do have a handle on, that we do know that time is always moving forward, and that things are changing, that time is change. But then beyond that fact, I'm not sure you could define it in so many different ways. You can try to embrace it in so many different ways. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
One of the things that you brought up that was interesting about the science and arts that I thought was great is that you said they're both investigating, they're both exploring these concepts in different sorts of ways. And I liked how I got the sense that that what artists are doing is always opening up to the potential of not knowing. And then sometimes I think scientists are very interested in knowing. And there's this kind of nice way that they work together. You know, and they kind of revitalize each other. So that's my pitch for that. I think the circles, could I say, she's working with these circles, and I remember hearing you say something about floral. Where do the circles come from in terms of using those as kind of part of your matrix to start a work?
They grew out of the work that I had been doing, and okay. I've been using, originally I was interested in the form as a way of holding the drawing still. Now it's become the opposite. But it's sort of a device. I mean, it's, you know, the circle has meaning, but it's in terms of the structure of the drawing, the circle is a device to move it forward. So it's not, I'm fully aware of the references that come out of it, but it's not intentional.
Okay, we've got, let's go here and then over to you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I have a question. We're talking about time, and I would like to know how much time in our conventional way of looking at time took you to do that piece at the Phillips. And second, a little bit related to what Ryan mentioned of the passage of time with your body. Your work is so physical to me. Did your body time you in this piece? For example, the level of exhaustion that you probably felt at one point, did that stop you for a while and time your work?
I think I spent about 2 weeks. Is that right, Vesela? I think it was interrupted by the snowpocalypse. Yes.
In which time you got really anxious to come back.
Yes. But I think in all, I spent a couple weeks. I work differently with time when I'm on a deadline, as we all do. But it actually, it really changes my relationship to the process of making the work, because I really, there's not a lot of contemplation, which is fine. I think it is an interesting, it has an interesting effect on what I do. I don't actually have, even though the work is really demanding physically, I don't get physically exhausted by it. Maybe because it's slow. Maybe because making it is slow. So that isn't a factor, although a lot of people think that it would be. I mean, I have gotten injuries from it, but not this piece, but the Phillips.
Well, actually, oh.
What was the second? What did
I? Did you
I
have
miss?
Another question?
Okay. Just postscriptum, not a commentary. We have to kick you out often out of the museum, and we have regulation very strict, 7 or 8 p.m. She always asks for trouble asking for extensions. So I think part of the work is intensity and working intensely within the certain time structure, as slow as you got moving. But it was the intensity that I think really it was important in terms of how we think about time.
It may not be that different than other deadlines, but maybe it is. I'm not sure because I'm an artist, and so I don't have other, I don't generally have other kinds of deadlines, but the, at one point you had said something during one of our meetings about artists and the relationship to time that we have versus how other people are working with it, but it definitely was, the structure of the museum. They have a very clear clock. They are on the clock all the time, and I can't really relate to that. I can't do it. I don't check my my smartphone for the time, except for when I'm coming down here for a talk. I know I shouldn't be late, but
hi. I have a couple of thoughts that might come out as a comment or something, performance question maybe. But I really enjoyed your slides, and I enjoy your work, and I enjoyed your presentation. The whole issue of time is so, for me, also interesting. I like your work a lot, and I think about time when I see your work, which one doesn't always think of the issue of time when you look at art. And just a couple of comments that I think that when art works, you lose your, as an artist, you lose your sense of time. It's kind of like when Einstein said time is relative. It really is relative. And so if you're faced with no parameters in a residency, and it's endless, it's kind of like the universe. So you have to invent your own time and your own calendar, your own beginnings and your moments. Each moment becomes a whole lifetime. Which is what I think when I see your work. And the slide I really liked, I like the slides of the people, of the prince, people looking at Earth as it moves, and also the Hubble. And I think that this Hubble, the new movie, or the new photographs from Hubble, we kind of have to deal with in terms of time, because we are now able to see 600 trillion light years into the future. We also know that the universe is moving and expanding. So we have to think it's almost like 1968 or 69 when we looked at ourselves as a little blue marble in space, and it kind of interconnected everybody. And I feel like this new image of the Hubble and this huge galaxy that they focused on, this 600 trillion or so, is reflecting back on us and makes each moment, we can slice it up into the tiniest, I don't want to keep going on, but I think it's kind of like something we sort of will be dealing with, this concept of time, and not just in relationship to our watches or the moon, but in terms of the edge of what the Hubble records. I don't even know if it's a question.
Did anything come up for you with that?
Well, related to that is the ability, the increasing ability to chop the second up into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. I mean, we're past billions, we're past nanoseconds, and those smaller increments increasingly get put to use. We are able to fill them up with something, either communication or data transfer, or using instruments that we've never been able to use before. And that's what I was thinking about while you were talking about looking into space. There are ways that time assists that.
There's also the sequence that's so undeniable that you know, you'd have to take those little pieces and line them up the way they're lined up. You can't switch it around.
Right.
And that leads to action consequence, which is definitely one of the things that plays a role in the way that my work develops.
Uh-huh.
So the patterning in the work is due to whatever slippage took place in the line that I drew previously. So the work wouldn't have any of the qualities of movement that it has without that sequencing and without the action consequence
right.
element.
Right.
Hi, I'm a big fan of your work. And I had to be here today. And I wanted to tell you one thing about impermanence. I come from India, and there's this drawing, a line drawing called Kolam, which is done first thing in the morning and in the evening. And the whole point of it, the beautiful lines, is impermanence. People walk over it, and it's gone.
Yeah.
And then again you do it, and then again you keep on. It's gone, and that's the whole thing. When I saw your work and the impermanence part of it, mm-hmm. I was just so totally connected to that part of it. And also, I am an artist who is addicted to lines and time. And I just want to tell you, when I see your work, I think of time in terms of lines, mm-hmm. and it's people's journeys. Mm-hmm. And through life, and when they all sort of come together, there is a synchronization and the circle,
right.
and there's a slight touching of each other's lives and time.
Yeah,
that I think is amazing. Thank you.
Well, thank you. There is that connected quality, and it sort of goes back to what you were saying about, you know, the little blue marble in the center of all of this, that it kind of puts every little piece of it in place. So it could be anything from, you know, those little pieces of nanoseconds to, you know, our planet floating around and pictures of things that were taken by the Hubble to, you know, just the relationship of one little piece to another.
This would be great to just keep going until we all run out of steam. But my internal clock says it's probably about an hour. Does someone want to check their watch and see what that's like? Did I go, is it an hour? I'd love to check. It's an hour perfectly? Yeah, great. I didn't have a watch. I did that without a... That's something we can talk about next time. How do the bodies tell time differently than tools? Anyway, thank you so much. I just was really thankful for what you guys did today. And thank you, everybody, for contributing and coming to In Conversations. They run at the same time as Friday Gallery Talks at 12:30. We give gallery talks at 12:30 every Friday. So if you come to one of those, too, that'd be great. Thank you.